Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. If you think heroin isn't a concern in your community, think again. Experts say every community in Pennsylvania has a heroin problem. In fact, Pennsylvania now ranks third in the nation for heroin use and seventh for overdose deaths. What's behind these alarming statistics, and why are only a fraction of those who need treatment getting it? Here to talk about that is Dr. Timothy Durstein, chair of the Department of Psychiatry and medical director of behavioral health services at Mount Nittany Medical Center. He has a subspecialty in addiction psychiatry, and for the past 14 years has operated a buprenorphine or Suboxone program in his outpatient office at Sun Point Health. Unlike many treatment programs, his requires psychosocial therapy in addition to prescribing medication. Also with us is one of his patients. We'll call him JM. JM was admitted to Sun Point Health Medicated-Assisted Treatment Program in May 2005. He had developed an opioid use disorder following surgery after having sustained a gunshot wound in 2002 while being robbed on the street. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Pennsylvania's Physician General calls Pennsylvania's opioid crisis, quote, the biggest crisis facing Pennsylvania and the country. From your unique vantage points, and I'll begin with you, Dr. Durstein, what's the scope of the problem here in Pennsylvania?
The scope of the problem is really quite significant and is growing. And it's not just with regard to opioid addiction, but a variety of other addictions as well. To get a sense of where this may have started, I think it's important to go back to the 1990s when pain was identified as the fifth vital sign. So there was a significant amount of pressure upon physicians to recognize and treat pain. In that context, opioid medications were used in increasing frequency in the late 90s and into the early 2000s, and I think this contributed to the expansion of opioid use.
I think most of us can recall going to a physician and having them say, on a scale of 0 to 10, rank your pain. And it seemed as if in that time period, any amount of pain was something that ought to be treated.
Exactly. It was moving from a time when pain was perhaps under-recognized to perhaps going a bit too far in the other direction.
In fact, people are now saying that that emphasis on pain as this fifth vital sign resulted in a generation of narcotics addicts. So I want to talk with you, JM. 80% of today's heroin addicts started with prescription pain addiction. How did you become addicted to narcotics?
Well, just like you said, around 2002, I was shot and was prescribed OxyContin. Was on that for several months through several surgeries. And as a result of that, I wasn't able to stop once they stopped prescribing it. And at the time, I lived in an area where in Philadelphia it was readily available. And that was just the easier route to stay on it.
So you were getting prescription painkillers on the street?
Yes, yes.
When did you make the transition, and why did you make the transition from prescription painkillers to heroin?
I was buying them off the street for several years, maybe about 2 years, and the price just became too much, and heroin is a lot cheaper. So about 2 years after buying every day on the street, I began to buy heroin.
And how did you end up at Sun Point Health? When did you say, I can't do this anymore?
Well, when my life became unmanageable, and you know, I couldn't keep living the way I was. I knew I had a problem, knew I had to make a change. So I moved here to State College to get away from everything and then enrolled in the program.
JM makes an interesting point when he says move away from, because when you look at addiction, Dr. Durstein, 8 to 10% of those who use drug will become addicted. But I'm wondering how important is the social environment, the age of first use or the developmental stage of the user, and also genetics in determining who's going to wind up in trouble as JM did and who's not?
All of those factors are very important. Just like in any other disease process, exposure to, let's say, an infectious agent doesn't always result in an infection. And it has a lot to do with the host and the degree of exposure that may contribute to the development of an addiction.
Earlier, you used the term brain disease to describe addiction, which is a rather different and controversial way of looking at this. Why is it important to look at addiction as a disease?
It's critical in terms of how we understand addiction, because that will drive really how will we treat it, how will we respond to it, how will we view and look at persons with an addiction. When I was in college, addiction fell under one of my classes of abnormal psychology. And at that point in time, it was viewed not as much as a disease process, as much as a behavioral problem. And we hear that persist today in the term habit or drug habit. And that implies that it's something that can be maybe more or less adapted or changed at the will of the individual. However, by the time it's become an addiction, part of the definition of that really has to do with the loss of control over those behaviors.
Speaking of behavior, there are Suboxone programs across the state, across the nation. What's different about yours, different from many, is that you include psychosocial therapy as part of the treatment. Why is that important? And I'm going to ask JM what that's done for him.
If we think of addiction as a disease process that really results in many changes in how people relate with others in their environment, as well as their own behaviors, it's helpful to give them a medication such as buprenorphine to help reduce their daily struggle with going through withdrawal, which would be common with using heroin or other medications. However, there needs to be the rehabilitation of daily behaviors, daily functioning, relationships with other people, the ability to maintain a job, and so forth. And so it's not enough to just simply give someone a medication. It would be kind of like being treated for a heart attack in the hospital and not having cardiac rehab afterwards.
Speaking of having a heart attack in the hospital, you know, it was behaviors for many people that led them to heart disease or perhaps type 2 diabetes or lung cancer. And yet there isn't the moral judgment attached to those that there is for someone who becomes addicted to drugs.
I think the history of that really goes back to the early part of last century, when the use of heroin and other addictive substances was criminalized in this country. And so that was really the beginning, I think, of the development of the stigma that is very prevalent around substances of misuse and people who develop an addiction.
JR, you have been taking buprenorphine for the last 11 years. What does psychosocial therapy do for you? How does it help you to remain off street drugs?
Sure. I mean, it does a couple of things for me. It teaches me coping skills, how to deal with my problems outside of reaching for a pill or, you know, a drug. It also, especially the group therapy that they do, it allows for me to get together with other people that are struggling with the same problem. You know, it's easy for us to relate and to kind of walk each other through those issues. So you might have someone in the group that's been in the program for 10 years or somebody that's just started, and the person that's been there longer is able to help the new people, you know, realize what their problem is and how to help them change their lives. So there's a, you know, Scott, there's a doctor, but sometimes if the doctor hasn't been through it, you know, you can't really relate. So the group offers two perspectives, offers the doctor's perspective and then the, you know, the person who's been through the addiction. So it's a kind of a big support network of a lot of people just there to help each other.
How have you been doing? You've been in the program for 11 years. Give us an idea of what your status is.
I mean, before the program, I couldn't hold a job. You know, I had no money. I just couldn't manage my life at all. And since being in the program, I've gone to school. I have a good job. I've gotten married. I have money in my savings account, you know. So, I mean, it's really changed my life.
The sad reality is that only 1 in 8 Pennsylvanians who need treatment right now is getting it. Why is that the case?
I think there's several factors that contribute to that. First is that the disease of addiction frequently, significantly impacts and impairs the insight and judgment of a person who has an addiction with regard to their need for treatment or the potential benefit for treatment. I think that's one very significant factor. Another is the access to treatment is fairly limited, whether there isn't a bed available in an inpatient.
There's often a prison bed, but not a hospital bed.
That's correct. If there isn't a bed available, there's often a moment of opportunity where the person decides, hey, you know, things have come apart to the point where I really do need help. And that's a window of opportunity that may last a day or 2 days or 3 days. And if that bed isn't available during that time frame, 5 days later, they may be back on the street or back using, and that moment is lost. So there's certainly an access in terms of adequate beds. There's also issues around payment. So even though an insurance company may cover addiction treatment.
And in fact, by law, they have to cover some treatment, not necessarily 11 years worth of treatment.
That's correct. So they may, if a person has not been engaged in and, quote, failed outpatient treatment in the past, they may be required to go through outpatient treatment and not succeed at that level before they would be covered to go inpatient. And very often when people first come in for treatment, their level of need is greater than outpatient can meet.
Well, two things strike me about JM's story. One is that he's been in treatment for 11 years. And I read about so many programs that are 12 weeks long, when even the National Institutes of Health say that a minimum of 90 days is needed for a positive outcome.
We're struggling with resources versus the number of people that are in need of those resources. And whether it's beds or whether it's funds, there just simply isn't enough to go around. So one of the ways that insurances and treatment programs have responded to this is to limit the duration of treatment. And
which sounds penny-wise, pound-foolish.
It is in many ways in the long term, because it's a little bit like getting someone almost to the point where they could be in more stable recovery and then dropping them out of treatment. We go from having people inpatient, which is the highest level of care, to outpatient, which is a big drop. It's kind of like going from the ICU to outpatient, following up with your family doctor without step down and without all the steps in between that we do on the medical side.
In terms of capacity, as I said, only 1 in 8 people who need addiction treatment is getting it. Explain how the Drug Addiction Treatment Act is changing that, because I talked with a doctor who, he has an active medical license and took 8 or 9 hours of online training and is able to provide the Suboxone to drug addicts.
The Drug Addiction Treatment Act, or DATA 2000, was an act to allow physicians to prescribe buprenorphine out of their office. Prior to that, someone needed to go to a licensed facility in order to have access to methadone, which has historically been the medication used for medication-assisted treatment. Buprenorphine has, in many ways, a safer side effect profile than does methadone. It's a bit easier to dose and to prescribe. And so the idea was to increase access for physicians to be providing treatment on an outpatient basis, thus allowing more patients to receive treatment. This has been helpful. However, there simply have not been enough physicians to become enrolled in using buprenorphine.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia, and our guests are Dr. Timothy Durstein, Chair of Behavioral Health Services at Mount Nittany Medical Center. Dr. Durstein has a subspecialty in addiction psychiatry. For the past 14 years, he's run a Suboxone program at his SunPoint Health outpatient office that requires psychosocial therapy along with medication. Also with us is JM, not his real name, who was enrolled in SunPoint Health medicated-assisted treatment in May 2005. I want to get back to you for a minute, JM, because we know that your risk of addiction is greater the younger you begin to use narcotics or any drug because of the elasticity or the plastic nature of our brains. Most adolescents experimented. Tell us about your own experimentation as a young person.
Sure. Well, I grew up in this area and, you know, I drank a little bit in high school and smoked a little bit of marijuana. But other than that, there was really no drugs around like they are nowadays. So, yeah, I mean, really nothing at out of the ordinary as far as a normal teenager, a little bit of drinking, a little bit of smoking, that was it.
And do you anticipate, Dr. Durstein, that JM will need to be on Suboxone for the rest of his life the way a diabetic might need to be on insulin? And I should ask both of you that question.
Yes. I mean, quite possibly. I don't ever tell someone that they need to be on the medication forever because I can't predict the future. However, I do kind of describe to them what I see as a triad of what can contribute to them coming off the medication. One is what has happened to their brain neurochemistry over the course of time that they've used substances. Second has to do with their level of motivation to make the changes in their life necessary to avoid continued substance use. And the third has to do with really the coping skills and the ways that they've changed their response to stressful environments or stressful situations that might lead them to use a substance.
What are triggers for you, JM? When do you say, oh, I need to call upon these skills that I've learned in this therapy?
Sure. I guess recently for me, it's been big life changes. So like getting married, a lot of those things trigger, you know, emotions that are new to me or just I haven't experienced in a while. And those are often the trigger points for me.
Now, do you have a lot of friends who could use therapy but aren't getting it, can't get into a program?
Sure, can't we all? Yeah. Not locally, but I know people back in Philadelphia, yeah.
Now, I should say that President Obama recently asked Congress to approve $1.9 billion to fight opioid and heroin addiction, and part of that money would be earmarked for prescription drug monitoring.
The monitoring of medications, I think, is an important step, and that'll help reduce new people becoming opioid dependent. We're already far beyond that in terms of the number of people that we have currently that are using substances. So the monitoring programs, I think, will be very helpful in helping to reduce new people becoming dependent on drugs. It would also help those of us that are currently treating people to be able to see what medications have been prescribed to someone. That information right now in real time is not often available to us.
The physician I talked about earlier who had a medical license and then took the 9 hours of online training so that he could treat opioid addiction, he says what we really need is a state-run program that costs users nothing to get the Suboxone they need, the way clean needles or condoms would be used to combat HIV, for example.
Yeah, so improving access to care would be a significant way to help intervention occur more quickly. As with any disease process, the sooner that an issue is identified and an intervention is made, the easier it often is to stabilize that condition. What we see here with regard to addiction is that by the time there's a recognition of an illness, the disease process has already become very well established. There's no bright line that people can realize that they're crossing, going from occasional use to becoming dependent on a substance in an addiction way. And that's often not obvious to the prescribing practitioner when they're giving pain medications. Anyone who receives pain medications for an injury or acute pain has a degree of risk for developing an opioid addiction. We can screen and reduce the risk ahead of time. However, roughly 10 to 15% of people are vulnerable for developing an addiction. So the challenge of monitoring the prescribing of that medication is really a crucial process.
Well, two things are interesting to me there, and that is that I read that OxyContin was first developed and prescribed for terminal patients, someone with cancer, for example, to relieve their pain. How did it go from that to treating someone who's had a tooth pulled, or it seems like suddenly there was overuse of this OxyContin?
From my perspective, I think it goes back to, again, the attention to pain as something that we needed to really pay attention to and provide treatment for. And when we recognized that, I think the use of opioids increased. The other thing is that over time, people come into the doctor's office or go into the emergency room will often request pain medication for a variety of conditions. And if they already are overusing a pain medication that the physician isn't aware of, the encounter can be a bit of a challenge in that the patient is very much wanting something and the physician has a limited amount of time to interact with that patient. And so sometimes the path of least resistance is
to give it to them.
Absolutely.
The vast majority of narcotics are prescribed by family physicians and internists. I thought that was surprising information.
The vast majority of psychiatric medications are prescribed by primary care physicians. So they are the people that really get to see a lot of people on the forefront of what's happening. The problem is their ability to make good judgments is limited by the information that's provided to them.
How do you strike a balance between someone who is pill shopping or doctor shopping because they are addicted and someone who comes in and they have a ruptured disc and acute pain that is on that scale of 0 to 10, maybe described as a 12, and yet they're given something that's comparable to an aspirin in terms of addressing their pain? That's what happens today sometimes.
It is. That's one of the real challenges. Many physicians are very reluctant to prescribe opioid pain medications when perhaps they may be warranted. So we do a better job now of screening patients to see who is at higher risk for becoming addicted to a substance or misusing a substance. For example, a prior history of addiction or addiction to another substance certainly increases the risk. The other thing that primary care physicians can do is they can refer their patient to a pain specialist for confirmation of the disorder, confirmation of appropriate treatment protocols, and so forth.
JM, what are red flags that someone who's concerned about a loved one might want to be looking at if they think they're going from using pain medications to treat pain to perhaps a full-blown addiction?
Yeah, I mean, I think you'll notice pretty quickly a change in behavior. Missing money is a good sign. You know, either oversleeping, undersleeping, any of those. I mean, kind of any person that may seem like they have like the flu is a good sign.
So explain, were you conscious of the fact that you were getting into tricky waters?
Not at first. And by the time I realized it, it was already kind of too late.
How difficult was it for you early on to get a new prescription for pain meds? And when did someone say no more for JM?
So here's the scary thing. I didn't even have to try because it was so readily available on the street. So after my surgeries and checkups, I never once asked for another prescription. I didn't have to. So it was just that readily available everywhere I went.
But when you bought Suboxone or another narcotic on the street, it was more expensive than heroin.
Yeah, but it was easier. And when you're dealing with addiction, like you said, you get sick every couple hours after dosing. So it was a lot easier just to make it go away by buying something on the street than trying to line up doctor's appointments and work through all that. It was just the easier route.
Did you ever overdose?
No.
Do you know people who have?
No.
That brings me, though, to you, because now there's all this talk about Narcan, the antidote. Someone who has suffered from respiratory arrest, it can revive them. How widely is it used, and what would you like to see as far as Narcan use is concerned?
Its use is gradually increasing. Police officers are beginning to carry it. The ambulance crews carry it. So it's becoming much more available.
You can even buy it over the counter in CVS, for example.
That's correct. You do need to go in and ask for it, and they will get it. So I think that anyone who has a family member who has a opioid use disorder, it would certainly be a very wise thing to have in their home. Just to respond to what was said a little bit earlier, when someone is in active addiction, the opioid is a little bit like oxygen to them. And so if you think of it as oxygen and the deprivation of oxygen and think what someone will do in order to get that oxygen, then it really makes a lot more sense in terms of some of the behaviors we see that people with addictions may engage in order to get their substance. To an outsider looking in, it doesn't make a lot of sense, but if you were deprived of oxygen, you would do what you needed to do to get it.
How do you feel on Suboxone, JM?
I feel good.
Normal.
I feel normal. Yeah. I don't think about, like before I used to wake up and all my thoughts would be, how was I going to get my medication for today? My whole day and life revolved around that. And then now this allows me to just live a normal life and accomplish things that I want to accomplish.
And you wake up and you take one pill every morning.
Yep.
Explain, if you would, Dr. Durstein, how Suboxone works.
Suboxone is an opioid medication that, like heroin or OxyContin, attaches to the opioid receptors in the brain and causes a certain amount of stimulation of those receptors. We would describe that as an agonist property or a stimulating property. It is also a partial antagonist in that it prevents or reduces the likelihood of other more potent agonists to stick to that site because of how tightly it binds to the receptor. So if someone taking buprenorphine uses heroin on top of it, the heroin won't have the same effect because it can't get into the receptor. And so it gives a bit of a safety net. The other real advantage of buprenorphine is that it has a very long half-life. If you're talking about a pain pill or heroin, the half-life is just a couple of hours. Buprenorphine has a 36-hour half-life, so you could miss a day of the dosing and you wouldn't necessarily go into an acute withdrawal.
I want to end with this because we have roughly 52,000 Pennsylvanians currently in treatment. 760,000 more are in need of treatment. And we're talking about a population of about less than 13 million people. So I'm just wondering, how optimistic are you, Dr. Durstein, that we can get a handle on what everyone is describing right now as an opioid epidemic?
Well, I think the attention being drawn to addiction in general and in our state, opioid use specifically, is very helpful and very needed. I think we're a bit behind the curve, and it's going to take a lot of work in terms of working towards prevention to help reduce the number of people that are becoming dependent over time. But adding additional resources is crucial. The difficulty with addiction has been with us for a very long time, and it's not going to be resolved quickly. However, I do believe the increased attention and resources will, over time, gradually work to reduce the severity of the deficit we're experiencing.
JM, if you'd tell me, what final advice would you have for someone who may be listening who knows that they're on that slippery slide toward narcotic addiction?
One thing I just want to mention that we really didn't discuss is the buprenorphine in itself is not the final solution. I mean, there needs to be intense counseling that goes along with it. It's more about life changes. It's not a miracle fix-all drug. So I guess any advice going through something similar is you just got to, you know, find counseling and you got to work on bettering yourself and then you'll get to a better place.
Just to add to that, many people with an addiction have burned bridges with regard to the important people in their environment. And so even sometimes when they are ready to seek treatment, the people around them are so burned out, they've been lied to, they've been taken advantage of, they're thinking, okay, how is this time any different than the last 10?
And the truth of the matter is that it may take 8, 9, 10 visits to treatment before someone is actually in recovery.
That's correct. With opioid dependence, it's roughly an average of 4 inpatient treatment episodes for a lasting recovery to be established. So people will often think, oh, well, the first 2 didn't count. Well, the way I look at it is that each episode of treatment encounter is an opportunity to continue to understand more about addiction, about oneself, and build the skills that are necessary to achieve and maintain sobriety.
All right. Thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Timothy Durstein, Medical Director of Sunpoint Health Medication-Assisted Treatment Program. JM has been one of his patients since 2005. To hear more of this interview, check the links on our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.